Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
In Afghanistan today, it's a two-step of global antagonists, Iran and the United States.
This trip was necessary due to new developments in the region. The Islamic Republic of Iran has some initiatives to solve the regional issues with the help of regional nations and withdrawal of occupiers. Therefore, it was necessary to have these talks and make the necessary decisions.
That's Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad before heading to Kabul. Today he said the U.S. is playing a double game in Afghanistan, fighting terrorists it helped to create. The U.S. made its own double game accusations against Iran earlier this week, and with 100,000 U.S. troops in Afghanistan, the dance is hardly complete. We'll ask who's leading and who's following. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee. From Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, March 10th. I'm Todd Zwillick in New York, filling in for Celeste Headlee, and I'm here with John Hockenberry. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Todd, from Miami. I'm here today and tomorrow with our listeners at WLRN. Todd, The Takeaway is huge in Miami.
Okay, hey,
good morning.
Down south, good morning.
Can you read me? Can you read me from down south here?
Hearing you loud and clear.
All right, that's great. Let's get a check of the top news stories. Dueling visits to war-torn Afghanistan this morning, as you mentioned, Todd. Defense Secretary Robert Gates met with U.S. soldiers at a forward operating base in Helmand Province.
Came into an area that was totally controlled by the Taliban. Fought for critical battle space. Bled for it. Now you own it.
Gates referring to the Marja offensive just ended. Gates raised the possibility that some soldiers may get to leave a bit earlier than expected. The projected withdrawal date is July of next year. Meanwhile, Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad is also in Afghanistan, where he's criticized the United States for fighting the Afghan group it once supported. U.S. Defense Secretary Robert Gates accuses Tehran of playing a double game in Afghanistan. Meanwhile, Ahmadinejad accuses the United States of playing a double game there. Double games all around, right, Todd?
Yeah, that's right, John. And I spoke with BBC's John Line about the double game that's going on and asked him to explain exactly what this double game means between Tehran and Washington when it comes to Kabul.
In theory, the United States and Iran could have a lot of shared interests in Afghanistan. They don't want a resurgence of the Taliban. They want a stable Afghanistan. They want to reduce, of course, drug smuggling. But in practice, it seems at the moment they're more down to trading accusations and accusing each other of not being sincere in what they're trying to do in Afghanistan.
So pragmatic interests versus double talk and double games in Afghanistan. That was John Line of the BBC. We'll hear more of that interview in just a moment, John.
And we'll talk with Lawrence Korb as well about the situation in Central Asia. Here at home, President Obama is authorizing high-tech bounty hunters to search for healthcare fraud. He signed an executive order yesterday that encourages private auditors to search for improper Medicare and Medicaid payments, from billing errors to outright theft. They have special computer programs and get a cut of whatever they recover. Later today, the president heads to St. Louis for another rally to drum up support for healthcare reform. The Senate takes a final vote today on whether to extend unemployment benefits and reinstate some tax breaks. It's expected to pass despite protests from conservatives who say it adds too much to the national debt.
Now, John, if you're a Bank of America customer, the days of overdrawn accounts may be coming to an end. Starting soon, the bank will no longer allow debit card purchases to go through if there isn't enough money in the account. New rules from the Federal Reserve go into effect this summer, banning all banks from charging overdraft fees without first getting a customer's permission. Let's look at the markets now. Asian markets are mixed. European indices are up and futures are mixed. The Dow gets underway this morning at 10,564. The S&P opens at 1,140 and the NASDAQ opens at 2340. We talk food as we do every Wednesday, and when it comes to eating green-mindedly, we're often told what not to eat, but we've got some news for you this morning on what you should eat to eat green. That's coming up later in the hour, and we're also going to talk about how more people are putting off their retirement because of this bad economy. That's in a half hour, but we're looking for your stories. What was your original retirement dream, and did it survive the recession? 8778-MY-TAKE or post to the website, thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Hi, good morning. Todd Zwillick here, filling in for Celeste this morning from New York, and John is in Miami with our new friends at WLRN.
Oh, it's great down here in Miami. You know, you were talking about that dance of global adversaries in Kabul, Afghanistan, Todd. You know, it's really, really interesting because Ahmadinejad there in Iran has an interesting message to the Taliban, but the Taliban are Sunnis. Ahmadinejad, of course, is Shia, so there are religious differences and political differences. It's a very interesting sort of swirl he's walking into.
It sure is, John, and differences within Iran itself, apparently, about how it approaches the Taliban and how it approaches the United States. Iran has shown signs of wanting stability in Afghanistan, but not all elements in Iran apparently want that stability because instability there means instability for us. It's all very, very complicated, not to mention the fact that Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad arrived in Kabul today before United States Defense Secretary Robert Gates left the country, the two gentlemen in country at the same time. And as soon as Ahmadinejad got there, John, he accused the United States of playing a double game in Afghanistan, wanting to do everything it can, basically fighting a Taliban that it helped to create. This is only a day after our own Defense Secretary accused Tehran of playing its own double game. So just what are Iran's aims in Afghanistan? That's the question we have to ask this morning. And we were joined earlier by BBC's Tehran correspondent John Line. I began by asking John to describe the complicated relationship between Iran, Afghanistan, and the United States.
It's like Iran's relationship with both neighbors, Iraq on the one side, of course, and Afghanistan on the other. In a way, of course, the United States did Iran a huge favor, removed two of their biggest enemies in the region, Saddam Hussein on one side, and the Taliban government in Afghanistan on the other side. So Iran, and I never really quite said thank you for that, but clearly it's a situation that's good for them, and they have other strategic interests, obviously, in their neighbours, interests about security, interests about drug smuggling. Iran is heavily critical of the amount of drugs that go through Iran from the Afghan border. So in some ways, they do have a kind of shared interest in stability in Afghanistan. On the other hand, they're very nervous about seeing that number of American troops next door. They don't want Afghanistan to be a strong and stable American ally. And there have been reports and rumours and accusations that they've even cooperated in some ways with their old enemies, the Taliban, in order to undermine the American presence in Afghanistan, while at the same time criticising the United States for beginning to at least think about talking with the Taliban.
Seems like what U.S. Secretary Robert Gates is describing as the double game. Well, as this ambivalence continues with Iran, what did we learn from Mahmoud Ahmadinejad's news conference with Afghan President Hamid Karzai today?
Well, he, of course, just threw that accusation back of a double game. He accused the United States of playing a double game, of not really being sincere in its support for the Afghan government. So not a huge amount of substance, as far as I could see from the reports that came out, more of just kind of trading of accusations.
John Line, the president of the United States seemed to want to use cooperation in Afghanistan as a way to bring Iran closer to the United States. Listen to this.
The United States wants the Islamic Republic of Iran to take its rightful place in the community of nations. You have that right, but it comes with real responsibilities.
John Line of the BBC, do we have any sense of whether common interest between the U.S. and Iran in Afghanistan can bring Iran and the U.S. closer together?
Well, that's been an argument from some Iran analysts that forget about any kind of big bargains about the nuclear program or even a reconciliation with the United States. Just be more pragmatic and concentrate on issues that you have shared interests. And one of those could, on the face of it, be Afghanistan. I think the problem at the moment is that Iran is a very difficult country to deal with on a rational basis. President Ahmadinejad is facing criticism on numerous fronts. Even, I'm just looking at now, he's been facing a big battle over his economic policies, even with the parliament, even with, you know, basically people of the same philosophical colour as him. So he's a very beleaguered president. So I think really to think that they can have a kind of rational dialogue with Iran is difficult, although in theory, yes, there are shared interests in Afghanistan.
That was BBC Tehran correspondent John Line. He joined us earlier. I want to turn to Larry Korb, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and former Assistant Secretary of Defense. Larry, good morning.
Good morning.
Larry, it seems like Afghanistan is a place that is tailor-made for the double games that Tehran and Washington each accuse the other of playing. And it makes me want to ask, for Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, can he afford to play it straight in Afghanistan right now?
Well, the problem he has is that given the internal situation in Iran, nobody there can be seen as being pro-U.S., even if it's pro-Iranian, or nobody can make any really big decisions right now. You saw when Ahmadinejad, back on the nuclear talks back in October, actually put a pretty good offer on the table that they would send the uranium to Russia to be enriched. But when he got back home, a lot of the people, you know, in Iran were opposed, to that, because that would have been seen as being pro-U.S.
So what has happened? You know, we heard that clip from President Obama before, basically seeming to use Afghanistan as a way to bring the United States and Iran together, common interest. So from the United States perspective, accusing Iran of a double game doesn't seem to be toward that policy anymore.
Well, I think to understand what President Obama was saying and where the Iranians are coming from, you have to go back to right after the attacks of 2001. People forget that in Iran they actually had candlelight vigils, supporting the United States. The Iranian government then, which was not Ahmadinejad, but they condemned the attacks. And at the Bonn conference in December of 2001, where they installed a Karzai, the Iranians made it possible for that to happen by leaning on their allies, the Northern Alliance. In fact, Ambassador Dobbins, who was Bush's representative there, said without the Iranians, this would not have occurred. They were actually the biggest donors to Afghanistan. What happened was that then in January of 2002, President Bush put them on the axis of evil. And so they basically decided, okay, United States is threatening us. Then we went into Iraq. So then they started playing the double game. They said, well, we better hedge our bets because the United States may be coming after us next.
And now it seems like the goodwill that was fostered post 9/11 with Iran may have been squandered. The question now is whether the war zone of Afghanistan is a way for the United States and Iran to get closer together. Larry Korb, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, former Assistant Secretary of State, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Now let's check in on some of the stories we're following at 15 minutes past the hour.
Well, let's take a look at the domestic side, Todd. President Obama is going to crank up the pressure on Democratic lawmakers today when he makes another argument for health care reform. He's going to speak at a high school in St. Louis, Missouri. While there, he'll also push a new anti-fraud plan to root out waste and theft in the health care industry. Also today, the president will meet with Haitian President René Préval at the White House to discuss reconstruction following January's earthquake. Préval says he plans to personally thank President Obama for the outpouring of U.S. aid following the disaster. And following that meeting, you know, this morning we're talking a little bit about what is our responsibility to Haiti? What does Haiti need at this point? You can reach us if you have an answer to that question at 877-8-MY-TAKE or call us on the website at thetakeaway.org. In Haiti, the U.S. military hospital ship Comfort has completed its relief mission, is heading home now. The Comfort has been stationed off the coast for nearly 2 months while treating victims. Total number of U.S. forces in Haiti expected to drop around 8,000 in the coming days, down from a peak of 20,000 in February.
Abroad now, Indonesia says a top militant wanted in the 2002 Bali nightclub bombings was killed in a raid near Jakarta today. And finally, the television producer who tried to blackmail David Letterman will be going to jail for 6 months as part of a plea deal. Robert Halderman says he tried to extort $2 million by threatening to expose details of Letterman's sex life after appearing in court. Halderman apologized.
Just wanted to say that again, I apologize to Mr. Letterman, his family, to Stephanie Burkett, her family, and certainly to my friends and family. I will not be doing any interviews, and I thank you all for your patience.
Letterman said he was happy with the way the case was handled. And that's a look at some of the stories we're following. Coming up, overdraft fees, a thing of the past, maybe at Bank of America. Stay tuned.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
Good morning. Todd Zwillick filling in for Celeste this morning in New York. It's time for some takeouts on the stories we're following today. First up, story of a big bank looking out for the little guy. You serious? Well, Louise Story is here from the New York Times, as she is every morning. Good morning, Louise.
Good morning, Todd.
Louise, Bank of America says it's ready to voluntarily do away with overdraft fees on your debit card. Those some of the smoke and mirrors that banks used to use to make a lot of money off the little guy. Of course, this could also help Bank of America's faltering reputation. So the question is, a big bank helping the little guy or a big bank helping itself by helping the little guy?
Well, there's some of both, but, you know, this is what people talk about as the $40 cup of coffee. You just overspend, right, buy a dollar for a $5 cup of coffee, and you get this $35 charge. It's infuriated a lot of people, and, you know, the Fed is going to require banks to let customers opt in to these sort of fees starting this summer. So Bank of America is getting ahead of this a little. Citigroup already did something similar. Citigroup is not charging overdrafts for debit card purchases or ATMs anymore. Bank of America made a change in its ATM recently. Now what it does when you go into the ATM for Bank of America is it says, we will charge you a fee if you go over. Do you want us to go over? So this is all the banks facing the music a little, addressing consumer anger.
So when the crackdown on big banks and credit cards first happened, the banks said, we need to play some of these shell games with consumers on credit cards and their interest rates and on overdraft fees, or else we can't stay profitable in the consumer credit and consumer bank account business. Do they now think they can stay profitable without the shell games?
Well, I don't know if they explicitly said we have to rip people off, but certainly these...
Well, on 60 Minutes, I think they did, if my memory serves, but they didn't say rip off, of course, but they said that these business practices are essential.
These fees are a big part of their earnings. Banks generate about $20 billion from these sorts of fees. The thing is, they're giving these up, but we all need to watch where they're going to make it up.
Right.
So, you know, they have certain profit expectations. They have shareholders who, you know, pound the table for profits. And so other places that they're already adding fees, including, you know, taking away free checking, charging you an annual fee on your credit card or monthly fees on your checking accounts. And those sorts of fees will hit all of us. Whereas, you know, these overdraft fees, generally 93% of the overdraft fees were paid for by just 14% of people. Most people don't go over. So what they're seeming to do is move away from ridiculous eye-popping fees on a few people to smaller fees on all of us. It's kind of a democratization of fees.
Spreading the pain a little wider.
Spreading the pain, but maybe making it a little bit more transparent. So they're telling us all, we're charging you for your checking account now. It can't be free anymore. Whereas these other ones seemed tricky to people, and that's what really caused the bailout anger among people, is when they would feel like the banks are tricking them with fees they weren't expecting.
And some of that tricking was in fine print or complicated language, and one thing the new laws are supposed to do is simplify all that, make it more transparent. With some of the fees in the credit card world and some of them in the no more free checking world or some of them in the debit card world, is there one place where a consumer can know exactly what they're going to be charged, or do you still have to read hard in lots of different places?
Well, if you look at your statements, they are putting more disclosure and they're supposed to be moving to a lot more transparent, easy to read language. And there's even disclosure now around what the credit card law is requiring. And so you can look at your bill and find it there. I've looked at mine. I think it's still a little tricky to understand some of this, but they are supposed to push
even
in the transparent direction.
Even me.
Sorry, a little tricky for Louise Story of the New York Times. It's going to be a lot tricky for the rest of us, I fear. Louise Story from our partner in the New York Times. Bank of America playing it straight on overdraft fees, John.
And the headline is your card gets declined when you're buying the milk at the supermarket. Right. Hey, Louise, I know you're not into sports, but I was looking at this survey yesterday. Guess how much employers expect to lose during March Madness because their workers are going to be focused on the basketball tournament?
$5 billion.
It's something like $2 billion, something like that, almost $2 billion.
That's bailout kind of money.
Yeah, fortunately, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen is here to talk about the sports of the March Madness NCAA tournament. Good morning, Ibrahim.
Good morning.
So, first of all, you know, the Big East tournament is on. It's like the last of the sort of big tournament pre sort of dramas before the NCAA tournament gets underway. What happened yesterday between St. John's and UConn?
Well, it's the story of the good and the bad in Connecticut, because while the women have won their 72nd game and they're the best consecutive winning streak in the history of women's basketball, the men are in a state of disarray. They lost big to St. John's last night. It was 73-51. That's not a good score. Not when you're Connecticut was touted as one of the better teams. Their leading scorer had only 4 points and nine turnovers. His name was Jerome Dyson. And Kemba Walker, who's also a great player for UConn, he had only 12 points, and they committed 20 turnovers throughout the whole game. So it was really an ugly game. On the flip side, St. John's, Sean Evans had 19 points and 10 rebounds. They had lost a bunch of games, but this is the thing about the Big East. The Big East has about six teams that are legitimately could win the tournament, and any given team at any given point could win the entire tournament. So it's probably the most exciting tournament in the country.
And for St. John's fans who haven't had any good news in years, this was a big game for them last night. And are they going to make it into the tournament?
That is definitely a big question.
It's a question for both St. John's and UConn at this point.
Precisely.
Right?
Well, UConn is definitely out of the tournament. I think that's pretty much consensus and understood. Now they're wondering, are they going to get an NIT? Because there's about nine teams in the Big East that could legitimately go to the Big Dance, and that's what happens when you're a major conference like the Big East. You can have five losses, you can have eight losses, you can still get in the tournament.
Finally, does this sometimes favor these independent teams like Gonzaga, who don't have to go through these bruising regional tournaments before they get to the NCAA?
It's a great question. The Big East champion, or the champions of like the Big Ten, the Big East, the Big 12, they don't normally go on after winning their tournament and then go on to success automatically, because they get beat up and they get bruised in the tournament. But you get a team like Siena out of the MAC conference, and St. Mary's and Old Dominion. Those are teams that are in. They already know they're in. They can prepare now.
Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, Takeaway Sports contributor. Coming up, how much have you saved for retirement? Is it a paltry sum? You're not alone. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, everyone, and good morning from WLRN in South Florida, right down here in Miami. Many people retire to South Florida at the end of their careers, but many people's retirement dreams were shattered because of the economy. What's the best way for you to prepare for retirement now? We're going to talk about it in a few minutes, and also the record numbers of people who are underprepared for retirement at this point. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE with your story. But right now, let's check in on our top news stories at 31 minutes after the hour. This morning, Afghanistan is the site between a war of words between the U.S. and Iran. Defense Secretary Robert Gates and Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad were both in Kabul, accusing each other of playing double games in the war-torn country. Gates had this tongue-in-cheek response to the simultaneous visits.
Well, it's clearly fodder for all conspiratorialists.
I love that. As for the Iranian president...
لازم بود که در شرایطی که اتفاقات جدیدی در منطقه داره روی میده.
President Ahmadinejad said the presence of the U.S. military is not the solution to Afghanistan's security problem. Here at home, a second former New Orleans police officer has pled guilty to covering up a deadly shooting of unarmed civilians in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. It's a triumph of quality reporting by the local newspaper, The Times-Picayune. Police are accused of fabricating witness statements, falsifying reports, and planting a gun to make it appear the shootings were justified.
John, the Senate takes a final vote today on whether to extend unemployment benefits and reinstate some tax breaks. This comes as new numbers show job openings are up sharply this year, more than 7.5% so far. That means there are still more than 5 unemployed people on average competing for each job opening. And this could be the year that the number of babies born to minorities in the United States outnumbers the number of babies born to whites. That's because immigration has boosted the number of Latino women in their prime childbearing years. Latino women average nearly 3 children compared to less than 2 among white women. In 2008, 40% of children born in the U.S. were minorities.
Some white women have 5 kids, though.
Yes, some do if their name is Allison Hockenberry, I think. Some of them do, that's right. Let's check in on the markets, John. Asian markets are mixed. European markets are up and futures are up this morning. The Dow gets underway at 10,564. The S&P opens at 1,140. And the NASDAQ opens at 2340. Those are some of the news stories we're watching this morning.
So a lot of us understood that the financial meltdown was deadly serious when it finally appeared on South Park.
I got a $100 check from my grandma, and my dad said I need to put it in the bank so it can grow over the years.
Well, that's fantastic. A really smart decision, young man. We can put that check in a money market mutual fund. Then we'll reinvest the earnings into foreign currency accounts with compounding interest, and it's gone.
What?
It's gone. It's all gone.
It's gone. It's all gone. That wasn't just a punchline from South Park. That was the kind of thing that people were hearing all over the United States. And a new survey reveals just how many people have heard it's gone, it's all gone, or near gone. According to the 2010 Retirement Confidence Survey by the Employment Benefit Research Institute, almost 24% of workers in the last year said they were delaying their retirement, mostly because they, as a result of the meltdown, couldn't afford to stop working anymore. David C. John joins us now. He's co-director of the Retirement Securities Project at the Brookings Institution and a senior fellow at the Heritage Foundation. Good morning, David John.
Good morning.
Also with us is Mike Munger, who's chair of political science and professor of economics at Duke University. Good morning, professor.
Good morning.
First of all, David John, let's talk about these numbers that we reported all day yesterday. It's something like 27% of Americans have $1,000 or less in the bank. And if you're talking about people who have been accumulating retirement over a long period of time, their balances are dangerously low. Give us the big picture here.
Well, the big picture is that this survey covered both people who were close to retirement and much younger people who had looked at their retirement accounts and realized that they had lost a substantial amount of money. Now, in many cases, this included people who had never really started saving in the first place. Almost half of Americans have never really sat down and figured out what they're going to need in retirement and come up with a decent plan on this. However, we've got to remember that the number of people with $1,000 or less include many lower-income workers for whom Social Security will be a much better part of their retirement savings than, say, upper- and middle-income workers.
Now, are these people just basically, you know, close to having their face in the pavement? I mean, $1,000, that's not any kind of a margin for error with rents the way they are these days and mortgage payments the way they are these days. How do families function with that level of buffer, David John?
Well, in many cases, actually, they get into very severe trouble. This is the case where the slightest bump in the road, whether it's car repair or whether it's in a medical emergency or losing a job especially, puts them in very deep distress.
And that has implications for Washington policymakers deciding on extending unemployment benefits, tax breaks, all that sort of thing. Mike Munger, chair of political science and professor of economics at Duke University. There's a ripple effect, a chain reaction here. If workers are delaying retirement, that means they're working longer. That means they're holding on to jobs that younger people might take. That's just one of the ripple effects of these kinds of numbers here. Describe what's likely to occur over the next 10 years.
Well, there's two things that are going to happen. If people try to stay on longer, they're also probably going to try to invest more in stock or other high rates of return. If you do a survey, 62% of the people that thought they lost money say, no, I'm going to get it back. So they're pursuing kind of radical investment strategies to try to get it back. The other thing is 37% of the people that are going to retire, and you can't see, but I'm making air quotes, that are going to retire, it's going to be unplanned or involuntary as a result of layoffs or saying, I'm sorry, we have to cut your position. So a lot of people think they're going to delay retirement, but what that means is they're going to have an unplanned retirement. If you put those two effects together, the effect on the economy is pretty catastrophic.
You know, Mike Munger, you've actually just figured out how to do air quotes on the radio. I think that's a legacy for you, just no matter what you do there at Duke University.
Proud.
Indeed. Let's talk for a moment. It's not just individual families who are making these decisions to try to catch up. Yesterday, we had a story on the show, Louise's story from the New York Times, saying that state pension funds are trying to catch up by making these unrealistic investments in derivatives and high-risk corporate bonds. What's the potential that people will end up in further disaster if these risky investments go bad?
The next thing is lottery tickets. They're going to be buying scratch-off tickets.
Well, I don't want to just simply point out the dire situation without suggesting, what needs to be done. What are concrete steps that families can take to avoid the kind of lottery ticket scenario and to hold on to what they have, even though it's shrinking?
This isn't very complicated. What you need is, at your retirement, an amount, let's call it X, 5% of which is 80% of your current income. Now, the easy way to think of that is, what is your income? Multiply that by 16. That's how much you need. So if you're making $50,000 a year, you need to have saved $800,000 in order to be able to retire at a decent amount of your current income. If you're 30, you can do that. It's actually not very difficult. The problem is the people who are 70 who haven't put anything away. But if you're 30, all you have to do is put away something like $1,000 a month and have a plan and make yourself do it. That's the first thing that you do, particularly if the company that you work for has some kind of 401k or matching plan. The big problem is people don't choose jobs based on the retirement benefits. They choose based on short-run things. So we need a change in the way that we think about it. But for younger people, there's nothing difficult about this.
All right. Mike Munger, Chair of Political Science and Professor of Economics at Duke University. He talked to us from Durham, North Carolina. We're looking for your stories. What was your original retirement dream? How much has the economy shattered that? And if you're close to retirement, if you're more in the 50, 60, 70 age zone, give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post it to our website, thetakeaway.org. Also, thanks to David C. John, co-director of the Retirement Securities Project at the Brookings Institution and a senior fellow at the Heritage Foundation. Disturbing numbers. Nothing funny about it at all.
We're going on a mission. Everybody get back! Go, go, go!
There's an excerpt from The Hurt Locker, star of this year's Oscars, of course, winning 6 Oscars, including Best Picture. The New York Times declared it the best American feature film yet about the war in Iraq. But the question is, how true to life is the film? It's a docudrama that tries to play very close to reality, and we want to find out just how close to reality it plays. And the BBC correspondent Hugh Sykes has been with members of the Real Explosives Ordnance Disposal Team in Baghdad, where they've been training the Iraqi Federal Police, the real-life guys who are portrayed in The Hurt Locker. Hugh, good morning.
Good morning. I'll tell you where I am. It's really interesting. I'm walking along the mostly disused railway line in Amman in Jordan. I'm just on my way home from Baghdad to London. The railway line where a lot of The Hurt Locker was filmed. And you ask how true to life is it? Well, there's two aspects to that, the EOD aspect and the Iraq aspect. There's no Iraqi characters to speak of in this film. It's incredibly smug. It's incredibly self-satisfied about the wonderful work that the bomb disposal teams do. Catherine Bigelow paid tribute to all the Americans who've lost their lives in Iraq since 2003, but didn't mention the nearly a million or more civilians in Iraq who've lost their lives since 2003. So on that level, the film is a kind of propaganda trying to make people forget the awful things that happened in Iraq and just concentrate on the wonderful work of the EOD, which is wonderful. The EOD, the bomb disposal team who I went to see in Baghdad the other day, say the film is very true to life from their point of view. The big suit, Tony Renault wears, when he approaches the unexploded ordnance, is very realistic. They told me, they showed me it, they put it on for me, they let me interview them while they were wearing it. And the wonderful little robot, which is called Talon, is also very realistic. There's one part of the movie, though, that they really, really think is ridiculous, and that's where the lead character goes out into Baghdad on his own wearing a hoodie. They say, well, if we did that, we'd be clapped into jail and sent back home to the United States and discharged from the military.
He goes out to find his young adolescent friend there. Well, Hugh Sykes, you interviewed two American service personnel on the team, Captain Jason Stewart and Lieutenant Sam Dimmock. I want to listen to a piece of your interview right here.
It's very rewarding. It's the most rewarding experience I think anyone could ever have.
There is definitely a satisfaction with that, knowing that you've gotten rid of another IED that could have killed somebody.
A lot of adrenaline.
Oh, yeah.
You love it, don't you?
Yes. Yeah.
Once you know you're alive.
Hugh Sykes from the BBC, a rush of adrenaline that they admit that they love. You know, the Hurt Locker makes the point that war is a drug, and that drug is addictive.
Well, look, I mean, that's very unfair. War may be a drug for some of the gung-ho guys who like to shoot people, but it's a good drug in this sense, because the people who are doing the bomb disposal, so far as I can see, are doing nothing but good. They're saving the lives of people who might be killed by these bombs. So if they're getting a drug kick out of the adrenaline of actually defusing things which might cause mass murder, hey, that's a drug that I'm quite happy to take.
Sure, and, well, Hugh, most of the guys who saw this film that you talked to, even though you find it self-serving, they enjoy themselves watching that film?
Yeah, I think, yeah, they did. They did. I said, would you watch it again? They said, no. I mean, I've seen it three times, partly
because you really hated it.
What?
Because you really hated it. You saw it three times, Hugh Sykes from the BBC.
No. I didn't hate it, but I'm trying to be objective about it. And everybody's gushing with enthusiasm, and
Right. Nobody's
mentioning the other side, which is that there's not an Iraqi perspective in it, and
well,
I think there ought to be.
And we certainly appreciate that, the Iraqi perspective as well. Hugh Sykes from the BBC, from Amman, Jordan.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. I'm Todd Zwilligan for Celeste Headley this morning and here with John Hockenberry, who's in Miami. Coming up, we talk food as we do every Wednesday. Now, when it comes to eating in a green way, green-minded eating, eco-eating, we're often told what not to eat, but we're not usually told what you should eat. And we've got some of that advice this morning, and trust me, it's veering into the land of the exotic. So stay tuned for that. It's coming up in just a few moments. Right now, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes past the hour.
Veering into the land of the exotic. That sounds scary.
Well, I might be taking one for the team in a culinary sense, Hawk, so I can call you Hawk again, John, so stay tuned. President Obama, meanwhile, is making his closing arguments for a healthcare overhaul in St. Louis today. Opponents are stepping up their efforts as well. Today, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce will start running ads that argue the healthcare measure is too expensive. Before he heads to St. Louis, the president will meet with the Haitian president, René Préval, at the White House this morning. Préval says he's grateful for U.S. help in the wake of January's earthquake, but he says the aid is now discouraging economic activity in his country.
No discouraging of economic activity in China. It's reporting what might be an embarrassing success story. Its imports are up well over 40%. To get more on this, we spoke with the BBC's Michael Bristow. He joined us from Beijing, and I started by asking him if it's really all good news for China.
Well, yes, it is good news on the face of it. Exports for February were up by nearly 50% on 2009. That's a massive increase and really a real about change from last year for exporters. If you remember last year, many factories in China had to close, workers had to be laid off because people around the world just weren't buying Chinese-made goods. Now there's the reverse situation. Many exporters, particularly in the south of China, in Guangdong province and provinces such as that, are saying they can't find enough workers to fulfill orders. So really, another indication that the Chinese economy has weathered the worst of the economic crisis and is back on track. And really, the Chinese export machine is humming like it did before the economic crisis.
Humming, some might say screaming. Michael Bristow, this is a double-edged story here. On the one hand, it shows how China has been quickly able to bounce back. But it also shows that world demand is coming around, and that's good news for the rest of the world.
Well, it is good news for the rest of the world, yes, because, of course, who's buying these Chinese products? It's people in America and in Europe and places like that. But as you mentioned or alluded to earlier on there, it's not perhaps all good news, because this might raise pressure on the Chinese government to once again allow its currency, the yuan, to start and appreciate. What happened was many people in the US and in Europe, they believe that the Chinese currency is held artificially low. Now, what does that do? That makes Chinese exports cheap, and so they can sell them abroad more easily. Some would argue abroad that these latest figures suggest that this is indeed the case, and so perhaps people, foreign governments and businesses outside China might be saying, look, these figures show you should allow the yuan to start appreciating once again. They stopped the appreciation a couple of years ago when the economic crisis broke, so it might be a little bit more pressure on the Chinese government because of these figures.
Good economic news for China, but it may be exacerbating some political tensions there between Beijing and the rest of the world. Michael Bristow for our partner, the BBC. And those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
All you can eat. Well, I'm going to stuff my face to a funky beat. We're going to walk inside. And guess what's up? Put the food on my face.
Food Wednesdays on The Takeaway. Now, when it comes to environmentally responsible eating, we're told all the time what not to eat. You know the familiar refrain, don't eat tuna because it's overfished, not to mention it's filled with heavy metals. Don't eat Chilean sea bass because it's harvested with bottom trawlers. Don't eat beef because of carbon emissions from cows. But we're told all those things, but we're not usually told what you can eat to help green menus around the world. Would you believe jellyfish? When I said we were veering into the land of the exotic, I wasn't kidding, because jellyfish is the latest green food. And here to tell us what else...
They're tasty.
I hope it is, John Hockenberry, because I'm...
It's great stuff.
I got jellyfish salad right in front of me, and I'm looking forward to it. And Eddie Lin, author of the book Extreme Cuisine and the blog deependdining.com, is going to help us with jellyfish salad and lots of other foods as well. We're also joined by Taras Gresko. He's the author of the book and accompanying blog Bottom Feeder, How to Eat Ethically in a World of Vanishing Food. Eddie Lin, I want to start with you. Your specialty is food that American eaters like me might consider shocking, bugs and exotic fruits and fermented foods and the like. What have you found out there that we should consider taking off the exotic list and putting on the kitchen table in order to eat in a more eco-friendly fashion?
Oh, jellyfish is absolutely one of them. In fact, I had a peanut butter and jellyfish sandwich for breakfast.
You did not.
This morning.
You did not.
I swear. I
really?
Did. Yes.
Okay.
Just to get in the mood of things, just like you are about to do.
All right. That's how we do it.
What if I could get my kids to eat that?
Well, seriously, though, jellyfish are a global threat. They're overpopulating the oceans. And the reasons why are there are fewer predators like sea turtles, sharks, swordfish, and certain Pacific salmon, and tuna. And this is directly due to overfishing and global warming as well. And not everything opposes global warming. The jellyfish love warmer waters, and they thrive on it, and they actually breed better in it. But, you know, that means there are just more of them for us to enjoy. So you can find jellyfish, and it's readily available in any Chinatown in America. It's on many Chinese menus at seafood restaurants. And they sort of have a slippery, crunchy texture.
Yeah, they do, because, Eddie, you say that jellyfish thrive in warmer waters. I'm trying to see here as you're talking if humans or at least radio hosts can thrive on jellyfish. And so far I'm doing okay. It's quite delicious. You know, it reminds me of some of the side salads you get with Korean cuisine, some of the kind of maybe kelp-based side salads. It is kind of crunchy and slippery, but
you know,
really nice.
That's a great point. The first time I had jellyfish, I thought it was a vegetable, which is really strange.
Keep talking. My mouth is full.
Eat your jellyfish, Todd. Eat your jellyfish. Finish everything on your plate.
Chew with my mouth closed here. Well,
this is the kind of thing where you keep chewing there, Todd.
Yeah.
You know, this is the kind of thing where if you go to see the Oscar documentary Cove, which is about, you know, the fishing industry and dolphins, you know, you might want to get a snack afterwards. I mean, this is an actual answer to that film. you know, the dinner and a movie, you can do both ecologically sort of responsibly here.
Well, you might get in some hot water there because the directors and producers of The Cove just busted that sushi restaurant in Santa Monica for selling whales. So careful.
So, all right. So we're on the lookout for eco-eating all around, and I want to bring in Taras Gresko, who's also here. Taras, what other foods besides jellyfish from the sea are you advocating for more eco-friendly eating here? Maybe some things that Americans aren't used to considering.
Yeah, well, we usually don't eat very far down in the food chain, and jellyfish are definitely far down in the food chain. Something that might be more palatable, though, are sardines and mackerel. Currently,
sardines
we kind
are
of
delicious.
Use those as bait, or we grind them up to feed to larger species like salmon or even farm shrimp.
Right.
And the thing about sardines is that there's a huge culinary tradition. In Europe, they tend to be a little bigger, like the Portuguese sardines are grilled and barbecued with rock salt. And throughout the markets of Portugal on Fridays, there's this amazing smell of grilling sardines. They eat them with potatoes and nice white wine.
And fresh sardines are delicious as well, not the canned brined kind, but just the fresh ones.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm talking
about.
Yeah. And they're pretty big. In Cornwall, in England, they actually bake them into a pie. They call it a stargazy pie because there are these six heads of sardines, or pilchards, as they call them there, poking out of the pie crust, gazing at the stars.
Now, Terrace, we've been talking a lot about seafood, jellyfish and sardines. Do you have anything from the terrestrial world that's working its way onto American plates here, or should be?
Anything from where?
Anything from the terrestrial world, land animals.
Oh, well, my specialty is seafood.
Then let's put it to Eddie Lynn. Eddie Lynn, what about some land animals, quickly?
Yeah, nutria. Nutria in the southern areas of the U.S., especially in Louisiana. Nutria was introduced to control aquatic weeds about 100 years ago from South America. So nutria basically is like an oversized swamp rat.
Right.
And they've overpopulated dramatically. In fact, to the level where they began to displace native wildlife and caused riverbank erosion. So the state of Louisiana, with the help of the federal government, offered a bounty for the nutria. And chefs were encouraged to work nutria into their menus.
All right. All right, Eddie Lynn, well, nutria is an oversized rat. We have jellyfish, and we have your recipe for mussels on the website at thetakeaway.org. Eddie Lynn from Extreme Cuisine and Tara Gresko from bottomfeeder.com. Thank you both.
All the bottom feeder recipes you can eat are at thetakeaway.org. We've posted that recipe for mussels. I've got jellyfish on the mind down here in South Florida. I'm John Huckenberry.
I'm Todd Zwillick. It's The Takeaway. I've got jellyfish in my bowl.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.